How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself?
On today's show,
the mantra that I like to keep in mind when I deal with that stuff, because I fall into this just like everybody else, is never miss twice. Because if you never miss twice, you know, it's like, you know, you stick to that diet and you fall off track. Well, you know, I wish I hadn't binge ate the pizza, but never miss twice. Let me make sure that the next meal is a healthy one. And if you can do that, then the mistakes are just like a blip on the radar at the end of the year. But that's only true if you never miss twice. It's almost never like the first mistake that ruins you, right? It's like the spiral of repeated mistakes that follows.
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I think, write, speak, and live all things disruption. Our guest today is James Clear, author of the instant New York Times bestseller, Atomic Habits, an easy and proven way to build good habits and break bad ones. It is a terrific book, full of insight, along with actionable, practical tips for continuous personal improvement. His website, jamesclear.com, receives millions of visitors each month, and his work is used by teams in the NFL, MBA, and MLB. Thank you to a Disrupt Yourself podcast listener, Ralph Campbell, for introducing me to your work and to you. Welcome, James.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Let's start with, where did you grow up and what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I grew up in Hamilton, Ohio, which is a smallish town, just a little bit north of Cincinnati. And I grew up kind of on the outskirts of town, spent a lot of time on my grandparents' farm growing up and running around the field there. And yeah, so I loved it. I thought it was great. And when I was a child, I the short answer is I wanted to be a baseball player. My dad had played professionally in the minor leagues with St. Louis Cardinals. And so I always wanted to, you know, be a professional baseball player too. But if it wasn't that, then it was probably an astronaut. I still am fascinated by space and the moon. And I can't get enough of it. So who knows? Maybe someday I'll be able to take a trip to Mars or something. But
I was just going to ask you, I mean, theoretically, it's possible for you to still be an astronaut, right?
Right. Yeah, that is true. And a very exciting prospect to think about. So for sure. So those are probably the two that were biggest for me as a child.
So in college, it sounds like you played baseball in college. Actually, I know you did because you've got this really compelling personal story, and maybe you'll share a little bit of that with us as we go through the podcast. But you said that you majored in something and it was kind of a made-up major. Can you tell us how you came to what you studied and how you formulated the major?
Yeah, that's exactly what my friends would call it too. It was a made-up major. So it was called biomechanics. And basically what happened was I got on campus and I was interested in the sciences, but I didn't have like a strong leaning towards any one subject. And so I took a variety of things the first year or so, and none of them were kind of like pulling me in. I was interested in a lot of stuff, but nothing was like really clicking. And so I've heard or found out through someone that the university would allow you to design your own major. And so I started digging into it a little bit more and found out that like all I had to do was pick out the classes that I wanted, and they need to follow some kind of progression, and then figure out a framing for them that fit that wasn't currently offered by the university. And so I ended up designing this major that I called biomechanics that was mostly a combination of chemistry and physics classes with a little bit of anatomy, biology, and kind of like sports performance stuff thrown in. And so it took me across probably four or five different departments at the university, which was cool and like definitely played to my interests. And it also allowed me to like pick the upper level classes that I wanted rather than being boxed into a particular major or track. So it was great. It worked out really well. And looking back now, that was probably one of the first entrepreneurial things that I did, even though I didn't know it at the time or wouldn't have said that. But that's something that like an entrepreneur would do, is look at a situation and say, I don't really like any of the options, so I'll come up with my own. And so that style of thinking has resonated with me for a while.
At the time when you created the major, what did you think you were going to do with it? What was your plan?
I was planning on going to medical school, and I did plan on that for quite some time. And when I graduated, I couldn't decide if I wanted to go to like a PhD program in the sciences or medical school. And so I was like, well, let me do something totally different and go to business school, because no matter what I do, I think that'll be useful. That was what I told myself at the time, at least. And I went to business school, And my job there, my graduate assistantship, was in the Center for Entrepreneurship. And so I was tasked with analyzing or recording venture capital investment in the region. And so because of that role, I saw all these people starting their own companies and getting funding, things like that. And that was where I kind of got the itch to start my own thing. That was where I was like, huh, you know, all these people are doing it. Maybe I could do it too. And so after I graduated, rather than going to medical school or doing more science schooling, I started my own company. And that was, 8 years ago now. And I haven't looked back.
What was the company?
Well, the first 2 years was just a total mess. I tried a bunch of different things, flopped around. One of the pieces of advice I got early on that was good, I think, was try things until something comes easily. And nothing really came easily for me in the first like year and a half or 2 years. The very first thing I did was try to build an iPhone app company, which was particularly popular at the time. The app store was fairly new, and there were all these stories about people becoming millionaires off their viral hit apps and stuff like that. And anyway, the first app I made, I think I hired a developer and spent like $1,500 on it. And I think in total, it made $17. So pretty quick, like $1,400 loss right off the bat. And I realized through that and a couple other business ideas that I tried in the first year that didn't go anywhere, that the problem was I didn't know how to market anything. I didn't know how to get the word out or like why someone would sign up for an email list or buy a product. And that led me to reading about consumer psychology and why people buy things and sign up for things, which led me to behavioral psychology and habit formation because it was kind of on the periphery of that. And ultimately, that's the search to figure that stuff out to build my business is what led me to reading more about how habits and behaviors are formed. And once I started reading that stuff, it was like, oh, this is what I'm really interested in. And this could apply to lessons I've learned as an athlete in college or the nutrition habits I'm trying to build or things like that. And the more that I read about that and began writing about it, the more interested I got in it. That eventually led to what I write about today.
So this is interesting. You made the comment earlier is you flop around until you find something that's easy for you or interesting. Is that what you said a moment ago?
Right. Try things until something comes easily.
Until something comes easily. But it's fascinating to me because it's almost like you went around the world and then came back to where you began. Because if I understand correctly, in college, you started out as not being one of the best players on the team, and then you graduated as one of the best players on the team. So you've been having this lived experience that led you to then the theory. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that story of how your experience ended, sort of directed you toward this theory?
Yeah, so I think that is true. I lived the ideas before I wrote about them, and I didn't, because of that, I didn't have a language for describing them when I was doing it. So as a player, I suffered this very serious injury, which I explain in detail in the introduction to the book, where I was hit in the face with a baseball bat. And basically, the fallout from that was very long and arduous, and it took a well over a year for me to recover. And my baseball career in high school did not go to plan because of it. But I did end up making a college team. The first year I didn't get to start, but I got to play a little bit. Second year, I was a starter. The third season, my junior year, I was captain. And then my senior season, I ended up becoming an academic All-American, which is something only about 30 players around the country are named to that team. And so the process of going from having this injury where I was placed in this medically induced coma and couldn't breathe on my own to coming all the way back and 5 or 6 years later, making this academic All-America team, it was a very long process. And each day in those 5 or 6 years, I was just trying to find little ways to get better. And I would do things that were not, that there's nothing really particularly notable about it on any given day, like making my bed or preparing for class or starting to work out consistently. And like all of those habits are on any individual day are not life-changing. But the willingness to stick with them and the commitment to trying to find these little ways to get 1% better each day ended up leading to a really remarkable result in my case. And I think that philosophy and my experience putting those ideas into practice kind of, you're right, came full circle as I wrote about habits and ultimately worked on and published this book, Atomic Habits, about this idea of, kind of an easy and proven way to build these better habits and try to get a little better each day. And so I kind of had the life experience first, and then came across the science and the language for it later. And the quest of the book is to take that scientific backbone for how habits work and how to change them and distill it into a guide that's easy to understand and easy to apply so that hopefully anyone can use it.
So interesting that you use the word quest, because as you were talking about this, I was having the whole archetype of the hero's journey play out in my mind of, you know, you get hit in the head with the baseball bat. That's the call to the hero's journey. And then you're wandering through for 4 or 5 years, figuring things out. And then the boon of the journey is discovering that there are words to describe this and then writing the book and sharing it with other people. So very fascinating. Okay, so let's go to some of the major ideas. The stickiest, I think, of this all is 1% a day. Tell us about what happens. You've done the math around this. What happens when you improve by 1% a day?
Well, I like to refer to habits as the compound interest of self-improvement. And the reason that I like that phrase is that the same way that money multiplies through compound interest, the effects of your habits multiply as you repeat them over time. So, you know, if you save like $100 for retirement today, that doesn't feel like a whole lot. It's like, well, I can't retire on that. Like, you know, it's easy to dismiss it as not being important. But if you're committed to saving for retirement every month, you turn around a decade or two or three later, and you start to hit that hockey stick portion of the curve where the compound interest takes off and the returns are all delayed. And habits are not exactly like that, but man, it feels like that a lot of the time. So if you, as you mentioned, if you look at the math on this, if you can get just 1% better each day and you do that for an entire year, so 1.01 to the 365th power, you end up 37 times better by the time you get to the end of the year. Similarly, if you get 1% worse, you drive yourself almost all the way down to zero. In the same way that it's easy to dismiss saving a little bit for retirement now or not doing it, habits are very easy to dismiss on any given day. You know, like, what is the difference between eating a burger and fries for lunch or eating a salad and chicken? Like, not really a whole lot. You know, like, on any given day, you are like, well, my body looks basically the same in the mirror at the end of the night. The scale hasn't really changed. There isn't really very much to look at there. You just kind of like make these choices and they don't seem like a big deal. And then you turn around one day and it's like, knock, knock, who's there? The consequences of my past decisions. Finally, they start to accumulate 2 or 5 or 10 years later. And so for that reason, I think that it is easy to dismiss, but actually incredibly important. And if you can capture that 1%, if you can make 1% improvements rather than 1% declines, then you'll end up very surprised with how much progress you make in the long run.
When you think about habits that you have decided to adopt and improve 1% a day, is there one habit that you would say, wow, that seemed so insignificant, but has made a huge, huge difference in your life? I suspect there are many, but does one in particular come to mind?
It's hard because they're like, my default, if anybody asks me, like, what's the most important habit? I always want to say exercise, because your body is the home that you live in every moment of your life. And so if you don't take care of your body, then everything else suffers as a side effect as a result. However, if I could pick another one, then I would pick reading. And the reason I say that is because reading is sort of a meta habit that can solve or improve all other habits. Like, pretty much no matter what you're looking to do, if you have the habit of reading, you can get better at it. You know, like, if you want to build a popular podcast, you can read a book on that. If you want to learn how to lift weights, you can read a book on that. If you want to figure out how to garden and grow better tomatoes, you can read a book on that. Like, there is a book for almost any problem. And as a result of that, building the habit of reading can be one of those things that kind of unlocks all the other areas of your life.
So what's your habit around reading?
So I have a little journal where I track my habits, and I don't track that many of them, but I do track my reading habit, and I'm looking at it right now. I have it sitting on my desk, and it says read one page. And so each day I just try to read one page. And, you know, of course there are many days when I'll read much more than that, but that's the actual habit that I track.
What are you reading right now? What book?
There's a book called What is Life? It was written by a famous scientist named Schrodinger. And he was a physicist, but he talks about if a physicist was a biologist, you know, biologists talk about how life comes from a single cell and, you know, like how we evolve into a human, what would the physicist's view of that be? So like if you tried to distill it down to like a single atom or things like that, if you tried to make an equation for it, how would you do that? And I haven't finished it yet, but I think where he ends up going is that it's actually quite hard to define what is alive and what is not. And the threshold or the barrier between like, oh, there's a rock and this is not alive, and here's a, you know, a fly and this is alive, is actually a lot more fluid than perhaps we think. So I don't know. I'll see where it ends up, but that's what I'm
doing. Yeah, fascinating. One of the things that you said in the book is that true behavior change is identity change. And then you go on to say, becoming the best version of yourself requires you to continuously edit your old beliefs and to upgrade and expand your identity. Can you talk about that a little bit and give us a practical tip around if someone's saying, okay, I want to change, I've got to change my identity, what do I do? Or what does that look like?
The basic idea here is that once an identity is adopted, then it starts to reinforce certain types of behaviors. And this can be positive or negative, right? Like you could have an identity like I'm a writer, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, motivates you to sit down and write. But you also have identities that don't serve us, you know, things like I have a sweet tooth, or I'm bad at math, or I'm terrible at remembering directions, or whenever I'm at parties, I can never remember people's names. And like those little stories, those internal narratives, those identities that we latch onto, they reinforce certain types of behaviors. And so the question that I had, and I think brings us back to habit formation, is how do those identities get formed in the first place? You know, like if we wanted to upgrade and expand our identity, if we wanted to look at ourselves in a more fruitful or more productive way, how would we go about doing that? And I think the answer is that there are certain types of your identity, like, you know, if you identify as someone who is tall or short, that are relatively fixed. But there are many aspects of your identity that are reinforced over time. You know, like you, if you, let's take like my own identity as a writer, as an author. Like now I've published a book, and so I look at myself as a writer. But a few years ago, I had not written many articles, and I had never majored in English, or like if you talked to any of my professors from high school or college, they wouldn't have said, oh, he's such a great writer. Like there wasn't anything about my identity that that identified as that. And so I started writing a new article every Monday and Thursday. And I did that for the first 3 years that I was growing my site at jamesclear.com. And eventually, I don't know when exactly, but I crossed some kind of invisible threshold. And it was like, oh, I keep casting these votes for being a writer. I guess maybe that's who I am. And this is the way that I like to think about how habits and identity influence each other, which is that every action you take is like a vote for the kind of person that you want to become.
And I love that. Say that again, James. Say that again. It's so powerful.
Every action you take is like a vote for the type of person that you want to become, or the type of person that you believe that you are. And so the more that you perform these little habits, whether it's reading one page or writing one sentence or meditating for 60 seconds, the more you reinforce, you provide evidence, you cast a vote for that identity of being a reader or being a writer or being a meditator. And again, there's no one instance that's going to transform your belief, but I think that this is kind of the deeper reason, or maybe the true reason why small habits matter so much, because we often talk about habits as like the pathway to getting external results, you know, like they'll help you lose weight or be more productive or reduce stress. And all of that stuff is true. And like, that's great. It's great that habits provide those things, but they also are the pathway through which you forge or reshape your internal identity, through which you like provide evidence of believing a certain thing about yourself. And so the deep, true, ultimate reason that habits are so important is that they shape your self-image. And I think that this is another reason why small habits can be meaningful, even if they don't get the result that you want right away. You know, doing 5 push-ups is not going to transform your body overnight, but it does cast a vote for being the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. And
I have to tell you a story about that that you'll appreciate.
Yeah.
I decided probably about 6 or 7 months ago that I wanted to be able to do 10 full body push-ups. And at the time, I could do none. And so I said, okay, I'm just going to start. And I started doing 10 push-ups like on my kitchen counter, right? Not too hard. Well, now guess what? I just did it every single day, 10 push-ups, whatever I could do. And now I can do like 15 full body push-ups just because I decided that I'm a person who does push-ups. Yeah. So I was like, oh, I think that's an example or evidence of what you're talking about.
Right.
One last question on that. So if, for example, I decide, okay, I want to be a person who does push-ups and I'm doing these habits to reinforce that identity that I want to create, would you also then come at it from the other angle of saying, I'm a person who's in great health, or I'm a person who's physically strong? So you're reprogramming your subconscious mind at the same time you've got in place this system that's going to drive the behavior so that the two can converge to one another. Is that what you're recommending?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I think personally, the way that I prefer to do it is to phrase it as a question. So something like, what would a healthy person do? And as you go through your day, you're asking yourself, what would a healthy person do? And then you take the action based on that identity that you're trying to forge. What you're describing is like telling yourself, you know, I am a healthy person, I am a fit person, like repeating these internal mantras or visualizing the type of person that you are, like that kind of thing. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. It's in many cases, you'll hear people describe that as like fake it till you make it, you know, where you kind of like are repeating to yourself that you're that kind of person or whatever. But in my opinion, fake it till you make it is a short-term strategy, not a long-term one. And the reason that I say that is because fake it till you make it is asking yourself to believe something without having evidence for it. You're saying, I am a fit person, even though you haven't gone to the gym yet or something like that. And we have a word for beliefs that don't have evidence. We call it delusion, right? Like there's some kind of conflict there with the brain where you keep saying you're something, but you haven't done it yet. And it's a slight change, what I'm describing, but rather than letting the belief lead the way, rather than saying fake it till you make it, I'm saying let the behavior lead the way. And by doing something, whether it's 10 push-ups on your counter or meditating for 60 seconds or writing one sentence, you have cast a vote through that action. And that action has provided evidence that, hey, actually you are a writer because you just wrote one sentence. And again, it's a subtle shift, but by letting the behavior lead the way, you have something to root the identity in, something to base your belief on. So now you can say, I'm a fit person, and I know that because I just did 10 push-ups on the counter. And so I think there's a certain stickiness to that that's a little more powerful than trying to repeat a new mantra.
Interesting. Okay. So instead of creating potential cognitive dissonance, you ask that question, you kind of go into this place of are being agentic. At the same time, you do these behaviors that allow you to accumulate or aggregate evidence that would suggest that in fact, you are this person that you're striving to become. Interesting. All right. So let's do this. You have four laws of behavior change. I'd like for you just to walk through them very quickly, like maybe take a minute. And I know you've got a grid that you can share and you can tell people about where you can find that. But then what I want to do is talk about five specific ideas that you've mentioned in the book that really resonated with me so people can walk away with some tips around that. So if you can talk through those four laws of behavior change in 60 seconds or less, please go ahead.
So I like to divide habits and really the vast majority of human behaviors in general into four stages. And basically there is a cue which catches your attention. So like, you walk into the kitchen, you see a plate of cookies on the counter. That's a visual cue that sparks the habit of eating cookies. The second stage is there's what I call a craving, which is really about how you interpret the cue. It's like the meaning that you assign to the cues in your life. So imagine that two people walk into a room and there's a pack of cigarettes on the table. And one person is a smoker. They see that pack of cigarettes, so cue, and it's immediately followed by a craving to smoke. The other person, though, has never smoked a cigarette in their life. And so they see the same cue, but to them, it doesn't mean anything. So they're just like, yeah, whatever. It's, you know, it's neutral. It's a pack of cigarettes. They don't do anything because of it, because the craving does not follow. So your interpretation of the cues matters a lot. That's the second stage. The third stage is the response, the action itself that you take. And then finally, there is some kind of reward or consequence, but with a habit for that sticks, it's rewarding in some way. There's some kind of outcome. And from those four stages, we can have what I call the four laws of behavior change. So the first law is to make it obvious. So you want the cues of your good habits to be obvious, available, visible, prevalent. The second law of behavior change is to make it attractive. The more attractive a habit is, the more you'll have that craving to act. And we can talk about some ways to do that. The third law is to make it easy. So the more convenient, frictionless, easy, instant your habits are, the more likely you are to perform them. Like, think about checking your smartphone. You know, like, why do we check our smartphones 150 times a day? It's because they're literally like a millimeter from your skin, right? It couldn't be easier or more convenient. And then finally, there's the reward, which is the outcome. And so the fourth law of behavior change is to make it satisfying. The more rewarding or satisfying or enjoyable a habit is, the more likely you are to repeat it. And so those four laws of behavior change together make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying, give you a way to adjust. Like, it's kind of like you have a set of tools and you can use them to adjust your habits depending on the situation that you face.
Fantastic. And you you have a grid or a cheat sheet that people can find. Where do they find that if they want to go and take a look at that cheat sheet?
Yeah. So the cheat sheet is within, it's in the book, it's in Atomic Habits. And at the end of each section, it continues to grow. And then at the very end of the fourth law, you have the full cheat sheet put together. And there's a link on that page that'll show you where to like download a PDF version as well.
Fantastic. Okay. So now let's get to really tactical. There are five things that I picked out that really spoke to me. The first one is the 2-minute rule. Can you talk about that? And what that means for people developing a new habit.
Yeah, this is a good one to start with. Usually if people say like, well, what's the first thing I should do? This is a good place to start. So the idea is take whatever habit you're trying to build and scale it down to just 2 minutes or less. So whatever your ambitious plan is, like, you know, read 50 books a year becomes read one page, or write my next book becomes write one sentence, or do yoga 4 days a week becomes take out my yoga mat. And people have heard things like this before, you know, like take baby steps or start small. But the reason I like the 2-minute rule is that it forces you to downscale until it's so easy that you can do it in just a minute or two. And even when you know that you should start small, it's still really easy to start too big. You know, like I had a reader that I feel like his story is a good example of this. He lost over 100 pounds. And one of the first things they did was he went to the gym, but he wasn't allowed to stay for longer than 5 minutes. So he would get in the car, drive to the gym, get out, do half an exercise, get back in the car, drive home. And it sounds silly. It sounds like kind of crazy to people when they first hear about it. But when you think about it, what you realize is that he was mastering the art of showing up. He was becoming the type of person that went to the gym 4 days a week. And only once you're that kind of person do you even have the chance to do a 45-minute workout 4 days a week or whatever. You have to master the art of showing up first. And this is a key insight about building better habits, which is a habit must be established before it can be improved. You need to make it the normal, make it the standard in your life before you worry about optimizing it. Mm. And the 2-minute rule helps you do that by scaling it down to something that you can insert, make it the standard, make it the normal, and then worry about optimizing and improving later.
Fantastic. Okay. Second one, point and call. What does this do?
So pointing and calling is an idea that I got from the Japanese train conductors, Japanese train system. And the basic idea is like, if you go to Japan, I was in Tokyo recently, and you'll see the train conductors doing this thing when they pull up to a station. They'll like point and they'll call out. They'll say like, signal is green, and they'll point at the signal. Or they'll say speed is 60 kilometers an hour and they'll point at the speedometer. And the purpose of this task is to raise your conscious level of awareness. And you can do something similar. The punchline to this is pointing and calling as a system reduces errors significantly. So the Japanese train system is one of the safest in the world, has one of the lowest rates of accidents, one of the lowest rates of errors and incorrectly berthed trains and things like that. And the reason is when you do something every day, like a train conductor pulling into a station, you start to get bored of it. You start to do it on autopilot. You start to habitualize it. And this is one of the downsides of habits, is that once they're built, you start to overlook your mistakes because you can do it good enough on autopilot. So you stop thinking about how to do it better. And when it comes to changing our own habits, one of the first tasks is to become aware of them. You know, there are all kinds of bad habits we stick with right now that we just kind of do without thinking about it. And then it's not until afterward that we realize like, oh, you know, I just watch YouTube for an hour again. And so the key with pointing and calling is that it raises the conscious level awareness about what you're doing. And once you become aware of it, then you have a chance to change it. You can do this just in small ways. You know, like whenever we leave for a trip, my wife will do this kind of pointing and calling thing. where she'll say like, okay, I have my keys, I got my wallet, I got my glasses, right? She's like calling out loud what items are so she doesn't forget them. And you can do something similar with your habits. You know, like you could just say, all right, I'm about to watch a video on YouTube again. And like, that sounds kind of silly to people to say it out loud. But by doing that, you become aware of your behavior. And maybe that gives you a chance to interrupt it and change.
Fantastic. Okay, let's go to number three. Be specific about the behavior, the time, and location. I'm going to give you an example and you tell me if this works. After I eat a lunch of bacon and eggs and cheese at noon today, I will sit down and practice the piano for 10 minutes.
The basic idea here is that, and your example is a fine example of it, there's a huge body of research called implementation intentions. There's well over 100 studies on it. And they all show basically the same thing, which is that if you make a plan specifically for when to implement your behavior, so implementation intention, a plan for when and where that's going to occur, then you're more likely to follow through. So for example, there's one study done on exercise that found that if people filled out this sentence, I will partake in at least 20 minutes of exercise on this day, at this time, in this place, if they filled that sentence out, then they were 2 to 3 times more likely to actually work out over the next week. And so the more specific you can be, the more likely you are to follow through. The interesting thing about this to me is that a lot of people wake up and feel like they lack motivation when what they really lack is clarity. They really are waking up and thinking like, oh, I hope I feel motivated to write today, or I hope I have time to work out. But by stating exactly when and where it's going to happen, you kind of mentally carve out the space for it and they're more likely to follow through. So there have been studies that have done this for voting, like saying when and where you're going to vote, what route you're going to take to get to the polling station. Studies for recycling, saying when you're going to take out the recycling. Studies for scheduling like colonoscopies or flu shots or other medical appointments. If you say like, I'm going to get my flu shot on November 12th at 1 p.m. at this location, and you have that written down a couple months in advance, you're way more likely to actually follow through and do it. It's all just different variants of the same thing, but the more specific you are about when you're going to implement a habit, the more likely it is to happen.
These are such great tips. Okay, we're going to go for two more. Number four is habit tracking. You said this earlier, and I just think it's really powerful, is that habit tracking provides visual proof that you're casting votes for the type of person you wish to become, which is a delightful form of immediate intrinsic gratification. So talk a little bit about the habit tracking.
So I don't think it's necessary for every habit to be measured and tracked. You know, like I don't track like, you know, how often I tie my shoes or something like that. You know, like they're like brushing their teeth or whatever. How often you unplug the toaster each morning. Like that's not, there are many habits you don't need that for. But for a few habits, for the ones that are really important to you, it can be very helpful to track them. And so the most basic form of tracking is you have a calendar and you just put a little X or a dot or something, you mark that day when you do the habit. And I've actually created a habit journal for this purpose. It has a template in the back of it that has 31 days for each month. And you can, you know, check it off as you go through. If you want to see that journal, you can just, if you go to jamesclear.com and click on books, there's a link to the habit journal there. But the point here is that habit tracking does three things that are helpful for building a habit. So the first thing it does is it makes it more obvious by creating a visual cue. So for example, if you have like a calendar on your wall and you've got like a streak of X's there, then it's more likely that you're going to see that and be like, oh, I need to do my habit today. The second thing that it does is that progress is inherently motivating. And there's kind of this additive effect of motivation with a habit tracker. So like my dad, for example, he likes to go swimming. And each day that he goes to the pool and does his laps, he puts an X on the calendar. And then he gets about 2 or 3 weeks into the month and he looks at it and he's got this little streak going, right? He's got a few days in a row. And that is inherently motivating to be like, man, I don't want to break my streak. I don't want to lose my progress. And so it helps get you in there. And then the third thing that habit tracking does is it is, as you just mentioned, immediate proof that you are casting votes for the type of person that you want to be. You know, it's really easy if you have a bad day or you're just tired to forget about all the progress that you've made. You know, to like a lot of the things that we do, like if you, you know, let's take your example of doing 10 pushups. If you've done 10 pushups and you've done that even for like, you know, say 3 weeks in a row or something, But then you had just have a bad day. It's easy to get down on yourself and be like, oh, you know, my body still doesn't look the way I want. Like, I'm still not as strong as I'd like to be. And I didn't even do my push-ups today. Like, what's the point? And you just kind of get in this little spiral. But if you have a tracker, then you can have a bad day, but you can look at that tracker and you have immediate proof that I did have a bad day today, but I also have showed up for the last 3 weeks in a row. And that's really nice to have that, and satisfying to have that when you're going through those tough days. So habit tracking can be really useful for a variety of reasons.
All right. Tip number five. So I'm not sure quite how this is going to look like a tip, but you said something that I thought was very powerful, is that repetition is a form of change. And if you miss a day, you give advice on what to do next.
So the point here is that often when we think about changing our lives or achieving some bigger goal, we think that we need to do things in a bigger way than we've done before, right? Like, okay, I gotta start working out in like a bigger way than usual in order to get in shape. But the point that with repetition as a form of change is that you can actually do the same thing that you've been doing, but just do it more consistently than you've done before. And that will lead to change by itself. You don't have to do more than 10 pushups. You could just, if you've only been doing it twice a week, now you could do it four times a week. And that repetition of the same thing will lead to change itself. In other words, I would say focus on volume before intensity. And that's true in the gym, and it's also true in many other areas. The key there is that it's the repetition that instills the habit, and that can be a very useful approach, even if the intensity is not there.
And you said something I thought was really interesting, is if you miss one day, then you miss one day, then start again the next day, because if you don't do it the next day, then you're starting to create a different habit. So just stay with the habit, or something along those lines. Does that sound right?
Yes, this is useful for what we just spoke about with habit tracking. And the basic idea is that at some point, every streak ends. You know, like I can do a great job of writing an article, you know, every week, and I did that for 3 years. But then there's one week where you get sick, or you're busy, or you have to, you know, do something for your kids or whatever, and you just don't have space for it. And it's easy to get down on yourself for that. This is especially true with diets, for whatever reason. Like, people tend to get in this all or nothing mentality where it's like, all right, I'm starting this new diet, and you do it for like 6 days, and then your friends want to go to happy hour, or you binge eat a pizza or something. And you're like, oh, you know, the self-talk starts. It's like, oh, I knew I wasn't going to stick to that. Like, why bother? I guess I'm not made for this diet or whatever. The key insight here, which you're referencing, is the mantra that I like to keep in mind when I deal with that stuff, because I fall into this just like everybody else, is never miss twice. Because if you never miss twice, you know, it's like, you know, you stick to that diet and then you fall off track. Well, you know, I wish I hadn't binge ate the pizza, but never miss twice. Let me make sure that the next meal is a healthy one. Mm. Or when I was writing my articles every Monday and Thursday over this 3-year span, if I missed on Thursday, well, I wish I hadn't done that, but never miss twice. So let me pour all my attention to getting back in there on Monday, getting something published. And if you can do that, then the mistakes are just like a blip on the radar at the end of the year. But that's only true if you never miss twice. And it's almost never like the first mistake that ruins you, right? It's like the spiral of repeated mistakes that follows. And so that little mantra helps me kind of cut bad habits off at the source and get back on track quickly.
All right. So as we start to wrap up, you tell a story that I think really encapsulates all that you've been talking about the LA Lakers. Would you share that story with us as a really an example of what you're talking about?
So in the mid to late 80s, the Lakers were a really amazing basketball team in the NBA. One particular season, I think it was the 86 season. 87, they started the season off like 29-5, which is one of the best records of all time to start a season. People were talking like, oh, maybe they're the best team that's ever been in the NBA. And they ended up fizzling out at the end of the year. They didn't even make the finals. They got beat in the Western Conference Championship. And they had all this talent, but they weren't realizing it. And so at the time, Pat Riley, who was the coach of the Lakers, he implemented this system that he called CBE, or Career Best Effort. And so they looked at all the players on the roster over the summer, and they compiled all of their stats going back to high school. And they calculated what the average was for each player in each of the different statistical categories. So it was things like points and rebounds and assists and so on. And then there were also some negative categories like turnovers, fouls. And then they also created like some of their own categories for like hustle plays or things like that. And basically, through this process, they calculated a score for each game. So you could see like what your average score was as a player. And then they challenged each player the next season to improve their average in each category by 1%. And Riley's thought was, if I can get all the guys on my roster to improve their performance in each category by 1% over the course of the season, we're going to have this really incredible result at the end. And so they would track each game. And then at the end of each month, they would track it in the locker room. They had a leaderboard, not only of their own players, but also of other players across the league. So they could like compare them to their competition and say, you know, like Magic Johnson, for example, was one of the famous superstars in that team. And Larry Bird is playing at the same time. So Magic would come in and see what his score was for the last game, and then look over and see what Larry Bird had just posted in their game. And anyway, they installed this process for the next few seasons. And not only did they win the NBA championship that year, they also became the first team in more than 20 years to repeat as back-to-back champions the next season as well. And so that career best effort program is a good example of how to implement this general idea of, can you find ways to get 1% better? Can you find ways to maximize your daily habits and then let that accumulate into something really significant in the long run?
Fantastic. All right, last question for you. So you've just written this book. It's, like I said, it's a fantastic book. And obviously a lot of people agree because it is flying off the shelves. What are you doing or going to do in the year 2019? We're just now at the very beginning of that year or this year, to improve by 1% as an author and a writer?
Yeah, good question. I think that, first of all, I'm not taking on another writing project right away. I'm going to focus on the one that I just finished. I'll continue talking about Atomic Habits, trying to improve the ideas that are there. And this is directly related to your question, but a lot of the time when authors publish a book, they start to double down on the ideas, you know, like you spend so much time. I mean, it was a 6-year process from start to finish with this book and 3 years in earnest writing and researching for it. So once you put that much effort in, it's really easy to say like, no, this is how it works, you know, and like not, and start to shut yourself down from outside ideas. But in a sense, I kind of view this book as like the most polished first draft ever on how habits work. And so what I want and what I'm excited to receive is feedback from readers and other experts on, hey, this is, you know, I think this is a gap here. Or I think that you missed something, or here's a piece of research you haven't seen yet. And so I'm really excited to collect that. And then hopefully if the book continues to be a bestseller and does well for, you know, 5 or 10 years, at some point I'll turn around and we'll do like a revised and expanded edition so that Atomic Habits can remain the definitive book on how habits work and how to change them. Because ultimately, I mean, that's my purpose with this, or that's my hope with this book, is that if you could only read one book on how habits work and how to change them, it should be this one. And if that's going to remain true, then I need to continue to look for ways to get 1% better and update the ideas and improve them over time. So that's kind of the main focus for me, and I'm excited.
Well, James, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. And I know that already from my having read your book and applying some of the ideas, I'm 1% better. So now the question is, will I be 1% better tomorrow? Thank you again for being with us and making the time. Again, so appreciated.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
There is so much here, a lot to unpack. As an overall theme, it's fascinating how the things in our lives that feel like insurmountable obstacles are often the path that leads to our life's work. James was hit in the face with a baseball bat in high school and put into a medically induced coma. The slow, incremental progress that he focused on while recovering from that injury took him to the college All-American team. Importantly, it gave him real-time experience in everything he teaches today. Because of my work in finance and with the S-curve, I'm naturally intrigued with James' assertion that habits are the compound interest of self-improvement. That if we can improve 1% a day, which doesn't seem that much, we will be 37 times better at the end of a year. So inspiring. With 1% each day, you can experience exponential improvement or drive yourself to zero. It's that way with everything that matters. And really, isn't it the implementation of habits in our lives a further walking out of how to be successful on an S-curve? Even though it feels like a slog at the beginning where it looks like you're making no progress, you are going to hit that hockey stick. It likely was a grind for James to write articles 2 times a week for years, but that's how he built an audience who loves his ideas and had an instant New York Times bestseller. He took the time to put his thinking into writing. He voted for who he wanted to be. What would a writer do today? They would write. What is your version of that? What vote will you cast today on who you want to be? Practical tip. Take a look at any goals or resolutions you may have set a few weeks ago. How can you update those goals so that you get 1% better each day? Choose your version of my 10 push-ups goal. Reduce to the ridiculous. Instead of exercising for an hour, you decide to put on your gym clothes and get on your treadmill for 30 seconds. Give it 2 minutes a day. That's it. It's a tiny disruption, but it will make a huge difference. If you enjoyed this episode, share it on social along with your 1% goal. Take a screenshot of the podcast on your phone and share it on Instagram or Twitter. I'm at Johnson Whitney in both places. And don't forget to subscribe. We have some episodes upcoming that are for subscribers only. Thank you again to James Clear for being our guest. Another thank you and shout out to Ralph Campbell for suggesting we speak to James and then making the introduction. Thank you to sound engineer Whitney Jobe, manager editor Macy Robison, content contributors Emily Davis and Libby Newman, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.